Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, find out how students at a Valley High School are using meditation to cope with stress, both in the classroom and at home. It's an interesting story from Rebecca Plevin on how a nationwide trend is taking root right here in the Central Valley. We'll also talk with Lois Henry of the Bakersfield Californian and hear about her investigation into how ag water from the South Valley is being funneled to support what some are calling sprawl just north of Fresno. And we'll have an in-depth conversation with Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen about her priorities for the future, turning around troubled parts of town, bringing Fresno mass transit, and public safety. That's all coming up on Valley Edition in just a moment. But first, the news.
With these news headlines, I'm Ezra David Romero. The California economy appears to be improving as the year nears its end. Ben Adler has more from Sacramento on the latest job totals released Friday.
By any measure, California had a strong November on the economic front. The state added nearly 45,000 jobs, and its unemployment rate dropped 0.2 points to 8.5%.
This is the best level of job creation in a year. The last time we were anywhere close to this was in October of 2012.
But Chapman University economist Esmael Adibi points out the state is revising its original report of October's 40,000 job gain down to 30,000.
The growth has not picked up steam yet, but I believe all the signs point that job creation should gain steam as we go to 2014.
He says that's because nearly every industry is growing at a healthy pace, especially construction, which tends to boost growth in other parts of the economy. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
A new California prison study says arrest rates for former inmates have gone down nearly 3% since prison realignment went into effect. The rate of convictions was basically unchanged. Capitol Public Radio's Max Pringle reports.
A few years ago, a panel of federal judges ordered California to reduce its prison population. To obey the order, state lawmakers approved a prison realignment plan offered by Governor Jerry Brown. It sends nonviolent offenders to county jails instead of prison. Jeffrey Callison with the State Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation says the law is working.
By implementing realignment, the state prison population has fallen significantly, which is helping to comply with the federal court order.
Callison says the number of post-realignment offenders returning to prison is down 25% since realignment, and that's helped reduce the overall prison population by about 25,000. The state still has to bring the total prison population down by several thousand more inmates to fully comply with the federal order. At the state capitol, I'm Max Pringle.
A group of activists rallied in front of the Fresno County Jail yesterday for nearly 5 hours protesting deportations of undocumented persons by the U.S. government. Protesters from the group Fresno Immigrant Youth in Action locked their necks to ladders with bicycle U-locks. The 70 protesters wanted Sheriff Margaret Mims to stop working with Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which keeps undocumented arrestees for potential deportation under the Secure Communities Program. Even though the group said they would stay as long as it takes, the protest ended around 3:30 p.m. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. 5 years ago, Fresno residents elected Ashley Swearingen mayor, and those 5 years have been some of the most challenging in the city's history, as the Great Recession resulted in severe cuts to just about every service City Hall provides. Well, the city has weathered perhaps the worst of the storm, and for now at least has avoided bankruptcy, but big challenges remain, not just in finances, but in shaping the future of Central California's largest city. Mayor Swearingen joins us now on Valley Edition. Welcome.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
You've been in office 5 years now. Hard to believe?
5 years, yes. In some ways, it feels like it's been a lot longer, actually. But it's been really such a pleasure to serve the people of Fresno. Times have been very challenging. But you know what? If it was easy, anybody could do this job. And frankly, I've enjoyed the challenge, and I've been very grateful to serve.
One of the big issues that's facing Fresno residents right now is water. Fresno has a water problem, not just a lack of it, but rather an infrastructure problem. The pipes are old. The water treatment facility needs upgrades. You're moving forward with a plan, despite opposition, to spend over $400 million on improvements funded by ratepayers. That means people's water bills are going to be going up. Why is this necessary now?
Well, I think everyone who has been in California, even for a little bit of time, understands the huge challenge that water is for our state. And all you have to do is drive out to western Fresno County and see the subsidence of land, literally land dropping many feet because of the overdraft of the groundwater supply. All you have to do is, you know, is look at the, you know, the big lawsuit right now between San Diego and the LA Metropolitan Water Authority. I mean, the water is the subject of all of the major battles in California, but we have a chance in Fresno to be the most water secure city, big city in California. We have access to surface water today that we don't use. We literally send it down the river because we don't have the infrastructure in place to take advantage of that surface water. So even though it is extremely difficult to tell the people of Fresno that they're going to see about a 30% increase in their overall city utility bill over the next 4 years, we can do so with confidence and knowing we're doing the right thing for the long-term interests of our residents and the future of our city. And even after that rate increase has fully taken effect, our water rates will be about average compared to other San Joaquin Valley cities, right? You know, right in the middle. Some cities more expensive than Fresno, some cities less expensive than Fresno. And then if you look at other major cities in California, we are dramatically below the average level for our water rate. So we know that we are still delivering a very high quality product for a good value for the people of Fresno.
Earlier this year, the city made an aggressive effort to close down several large homeless encampments. While many people did get help for housing and as other assistance from the city, the problem is basically still there. Fresnans see it every day. It's dispersed into neighborhoods. It's not maybe as concentrated as it was with those encampments. Do you think the effort has been successful? And does the county need to step up here in some way, being the main provider of social services in the way our state works?
Yeah, this has been just an incredibly challenging situation to deal with. Everyone that I know of that has vocal opinions on what needs to happen to address homelessness in Fresno County, everyone's hearts are in the right place. And we all have different roles to play. So in the city of Fresno, for example, prior to my time in office, the city council, as well as the Fresno County Board of Supervisors in 2008, adopted a housing first approach to addressing homelessness, which was really a big shift. And frankly, recognized for the first time that we've got a big problem when it comes to homelessness in Fresno, and we need to start looking for housing resources because the problem just gets worse and worse. It does not go away if you just try to turn a blind eye. So since that time in 2008, I'm really pleased with the progress that our community has made. The Fresno Housing Authority has led the way. They've brought on 120 additional housing units for chronically homeless individuals. They've also worked out a very successful tenant-based rental assistance program. We did it in 2009 to clean up the H Street encampment. And at that time, there was general fund money from the last Autry administration budget. So we were able to provide some financial support there. Today, we're doing that with federal grant dollars. And this next year, we'll spend $1 million on tenant-based rental assistance to get even more people off the streets. But recognizing that funding was the problem, back in 2009, we started Fresno First Steps Home to try to raise private money to match these grant dollars that we have. Those dollars go to get people off the streets and into housing. To date, we've raised about $800,000 towards that effort. All of that combined, we've seen roughly 200 people chronically homeless get off the streets and into housing. With the encampment cleanup that we did this last summer, 87 people are today in housing. And of those 87, 22 people are already paying their own rent. In other words, they needed a little bit of assistance to get their first and last month's deposit down. They maybe needed a little bit of rental help for the first few months, but they found jobs. They're now paying their own rent. So it's proof that when you get people off the streets and into housing, boy, they can deal with a lot of the other barriers in their life a lot better than when they're trying to do so out of Courthouse Park or, you know, an encampment. The city's role has been to prioritize housing first. My role as mayor has been to find resources, in this case, including raising private sector dollars. But number three, our role has been to demand a higher standard for the chronically homeless than just allowing encampments. Many have argued that we should make permanent encampments. But what we've heard loudly and clearly from experts across the country is that once you do that, you've immediately set the bar so low for your community that basically you're saying we have given up on these folks ever being able to get out of the life that they're in and live an independent life again. We're just going to concretize their lives in these encampments. And so we've had to be the backbone and the agency that said we're not going to allow that in our community. We want to see people in housing. We certainly need the help from the county, and they in many ways have been good partners, and they have many challenges they have to deal with, and we'd love to work with them more closely on this. But we've had to put those things in place. Now I think there's an opportunity for other agencies and the community to continue to respond, and my hope is that in the next 3 years we'll see another 100 or more new housing units become available for addressing this population.
Moving on to another topic right now, your administration has been moving forward aggressively on a proposal to bring a new sort of mass transit to Fresno. Some people would call it light rail on wheels, bus rapid transit. You have $50 million from the federal government to build it. But judging from the city council's response to a workshop a few days ago, it sounds like not everyone is entirely on board at this point. Councilmember Brandao, for example, says it's speculation to suggest that Fresnans will decide and choose to ride this. He's concerned about the costs and impacts to existing fax service. Are you frustrated that there remains some skepticism and doubt for a project that is essentially already paid for and that it doesn't have more support at this time?
You know, I'm not. I mean, it is the reality of the democratic process. We work together. We work through conflict. We work through challenges, and we find a path forward for our community. And I'm confident that ultimately, when we ask for the council's support for BRT, that we'll see at least the council majority be there. And it's not unusual for council members before we take a big step to say, wait, hold on. Now go through the basics again. Explain to me what this is. And remember, this project actually started well before my time in office. In fact, some date it back to 1996 and then later 2006 when a public transportation infrastructure study was done. So this has been moving forward for quite some time. And I know what it's like. In fact, we heard from one of the council members who's new this year, said from the dais a few weeks ago that he just felt like he hadn't been involved enough from the beginning. But the reality is none of us who are in City Hall today were involved from the beginning. This is one of those projects that when you step into office, you carry the baton. Something started before you. You carry it down the lane, and then you'll hand off to the next generation of leaders. And so I think we just needed to spend a little time with the council members, orienting them on what BRT is. And just to make it really, really simple for folks, essentially BRT is a faster service. So today, a lot of times people, if they have a car, they choose obviously to take their car instead of taking our existing bus system because they can get to where they're trying to go a lot faster. With a bus rapid transit system, you actually can improve service time such that it can be the same or faster than a car. And for example, if you live in North Fresno and you work downtown, you're paying for parking today in downtown Fresno. And what we'd like to see happen is establish some kind of park and ride facility in North Fresno, probably around the River Park area. All you have to do is get your car, park at the park and ride. Then you could take BRT to downtown and avoid a monthly parking charge. Now that's adding value for residents. That's saving them money every month, and it's getting them to work on time or faster than they would if they were in their own vehicle. So we think there's a real value add here for people who wouldn't otherwise look to take transit. We think we'll start to see more people take advantage of this service. And in that process, of course, we make positive impacts on the air quality. And I don't know about your household, but just looking at the air quality, even in the last few days, in a time of year when normally we enjoy pretty good air quality, you know, at my son's school, there have been kids out with challenges with breathing, and my son is homesick from school. My husband's having trouble breathing because of the soot that's in the air. So we know we cannot give up on this fight to clean our air. And BRT is one simple thing we can do. It's funded with with grants. It doesn't mean we have to compromise any other service level to provide this service to Fresnans.
And it's also tied to the city's new general plan and also the state's regulations on greenhouse gas reduction. So there's other moving parts here that really make it, as I understand it, a strong rationale for moving forward on it.
There are a lot of moving parts on this, and you brought up the state regulations. I think it's been sort of revelation for those of us at City Hall that have been trying to grapple with new state regulations that literally just went into effect this last year. So, for example, as a county, we had to adopt a sustainable community strategy, say that three times fast, pursuant to SB 375. And in that plan, which involves every city in Fresno County and Fresno County, we've had to demonstrate how we're going to achieve certain greenhouse gas reduction levels. We can't get there without the city of Fresno adopting the general plan that is being evaluated right now through environmental review, and that includes the bus rapid transit program. If we're not compliant with our SB 375 sustainable community strategy, then essentially we could face very serious sanctions up to and including not being able to see any new development happen, not just in the city of Fresno, but in other cities in Fresno County and in unincorporated Fresno County. So so there are, depending on how you look at it, that's either a big stick or a big carrot and a reason to move forward with a simple adaptation like bus rapid transit.
Speaking of growth and planning, the new 2035 general plan is very ambitious. For the first time, Fresno is saying it's going to stop sprawling beyond the current sphere of influence. That means infill development, not just downtown, but in older parts of the city, on Blackstone, on Kings Canyon, and building up and not out. But the world doesn't stop at the city limits. You have Madera County pushing some very aggressive plans for suburban-style developments just on the other side of the river from Fresno, and Fresno County doing the same in Millerton and Fryant. How confident are you that this new plan will succeed in the market, given that competition and that people in this area like to have single-family homes with big yards and swimming pools?
Well, and just to be clear, the city's general plan actually requires very few people to live, for example, in downtown lofts or in, you know, multifamily units over time that we envision on Blackstone Avenue. Some really neat transit-oriented development we think will happen over time. Honestly, it's like, you know, 5,000 people or so makes all the difference in the world for bringing back business and entertainment and things back into the inner city. So for the most part, we certainly recognize that our community is going to continue to be a community that heavily relies on single-family homes. All we're saying is let's focus on the existing city as much as we focus on new growth areas. And that's really all it is. It's a balance. It's 55-45. It actually skews a little more towards 55% of growth happening in new growth areas and 45% within the existing city limits. When I talk to residents across the city, particularly small investors, for example, real estate professionals who buy a couple of homes a year in the existing city, rehab those homes, and then make them available for sale and improve the housing stock in the process of doing so, they are so excited to hear that the city, our infrastructure, our policies, our focus and attention is going to at least be half on what we already have. And we all see the impacts of focusing almost entirely on just new growth areas. That's been Fresno's tradition for 50 or 60 years, and we've left behind some big challenges in some of our existing neighborhoods. I recall often, as many people will, Mayor Autry spent a lot of time in his 8 years in office talking about the tale of two cities and the dividing line being Shaw Avenue, and everything south of Shaw was starting to deteriorate, north of Shaw was like a different world. Well, fast forward just 5 years, and I would argue that dividing line is now Herndon Avenue. And I live south of Herndon. I live in a wonderful neighborhood. I'm so happy in our neighborhood. But I drive around in some of the areas not far from my home, and I see the signs of not focusing on our existing neighborhoods and improving the housing stock and the sidewalks and the streets and all of those kinds of things. The vast majority of Fresnans live in existing neighborhoods and will continue to do so moving forward. So the general plan really just recognizes that and says, let's put the right policies and incentives in place to attract investment and the private sector back into these neighborhoods, because I guarantee you we've got some beautiful neighborhoods that are just just on the brink of slipping into a total state of disrepair or making a comeback. We don't want to lose any more neighborhoods. And that's why our general plan has the focus it does.
Has the city's relationship with Madera County and those developments that are proposed also in unincorporated areas in Fresno County, other communities, that was tense earlier this year. Has that improved?
It's a really good point, and it certainly has been a big challenge. And I guess I spent so much time talking about our general plan in the city of Fresno itself because I feel like we need to address our own issues first and demonstrate that we're willing to make changes and reevaluate the way we accommodate investment and growth. And if we don't lead by example, it's going to be really difficult for us to go across the river and have a conversation with leaders in Madera County or step across the street in downtown Fresno and talk with leaders of Fresno County. So we really wanted to make sure that we were walking the talk first and foremost. Now, it is definitely time for us to have meaningful conversations with leaders from Madera County and Fresno County. We actually are required, according to a lawsuit settlement that the City of Fresno and the Madera County Board entered into, we're actually required to go through a deliberative and meaningful process to just try to figure out in advance how are we going to accommodate each jurisdiction's needs going forward. And I'm more optimistic today that there's an appetite on both sides of the river to have that kind of meaningful conversation than I was, say, this time last year.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, our guest is Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearengin. Let's turn now to downtown. It's a part of what you were just talking about. It's always a great source of debate. You have $17 million now in grant funding from the feds to reopen the Fulton Mall to traffic. As I'm sure you know, this isn't the first time a major city-backed project has promised to bring life back to downtown. There's a lot of people in this community, though, that are very skeptical of any downtown initiative, including this one, if not downright jaded. Why is this going to be any different?
Well, I first of all just want to affirm the skepticism that residents feel towards our downtown, and I understand it, and I encounter it all the time when I'm talking with groups of people, and I think it's good to be skeptical because we've had a lot of trials and errors in downtown Fresno over the last 50 years. But I would draw a distinction between some of the more recent efforts. For example, people will point to the ballpark. You know, why didn't that have the kind of results that were promised? People point to the failure of the Met Museum and other things like that. And what I would distinguish, this is simply a public infrastructure project. This is not the city proposing an entertainment venue and proposing to back a private business in their venture. This is simply doing what cities do. We do public infrastructure. Our approach in revitalizing our inner city is different from the past in that we're not trying to be developers. We're not trying to put taxpayer dollars on the line to incent, you know, developers to come to this area. We're saying, look, if we do our part right, and our part in city government involves namely the rules and regulations that either prevent or support investment, and that comes in the form of our development code and our land use plan. So we've changed our rules to make it easier for private investors to do what it is we want them to do, number one. And number two, we do infrastructure. And we can't look to the private sector and say, you need to fix the entire water system downtown, or you need to fix all of the roads in downtown, because that cost would be too burdensome for any one project. There are some public infrastructure investments that we're going to need to make to support private investment. Thankfully, we secured a federal grant, a very, very competitive federal grant. We were the fifth highest award in the nation, and I believe the only project that got the full amount that we asked for. So we did very well in this competition. We can look to Fresnans who are skeptical and say, hey, we understand the skepticism, but if you knew that we could do this project without, number one, raising your taxes, or number two, compromising service levels in any other part of the city. In other words, we're not taking funds from the pothole bank account that would otherwise provide infrastructure services in other parts of the city. This is entirely grant funded. We do have some local grant requirement in terms of a match, but those grant dollars we're proposing to use could only be used for a similar project in the downtown area. So once you tell Fresnans that, they say, okay, well, it's worth a try. And they all recognize the incredible value and beauty of the historic buildings that we have in downtown Fresno. As you know much better than I, Joe, a historic building stock that is unlike any in Central California, and those buildings are withering away without tenants without investment. We know from the property owners that clearly they are struggling to attract people into their buildings if people can't access their buildings.
When we look at just about any city service, it all comes down to the money that's coming into City Hall. Residents want services, but the city can only provide what it has. Part of growing that is economic development. I was talking with a listener a few weeks ago here at the station. We were talking about the state of the economy in Fresno and the lack of a diversified corporate base. And this person was very adamant that the administration isn't doing enough to woo outside companies to come to Fresno and set up shop, whether they're Boeing or Tesla or Apple. You come from an economic development background, and you've taken a very different strategy, much more focused on growing our own companies that are already here locally and focusing on a few key sectors like the food industry. Can you explain why you've taken that strategy versus the more traditional model of let's spend a lot of money and bring in Gap to come in and build a distribution center?
You bet. And it's very simple, and it's based on best practices across the country. It's clear after 30 or 40 years of smokestack chasing in the economic development industry, it's clear that that type of economic development does not work. You don't have that many opportunities to try to recruit a Boeing or an Apple or a Google data center or whatever. They literally do not happen all that often. 80% of our economic development happens from our existing businesses expanding. And frankly, it's a much faster path to job creation, and it's much less expensive for the jurisdiction. So the companies you mentioned, for example, any kind of site location they might do, and perhaps maybe once every 10 or 20 years, they'll go through a site expansion process, costs millions of dollars of public subsidies. I mean, we saw it with the Gap, and ultimately the jobs that were created there did not come to fruition, or the jobs that were promised didn't come to fruition. So after so many decades of many jurisdictions, you know, providing tax breaks, you know, trying to woo these companies to their towns, I mean, most mayors who know anything about economic development know it's much more effective to grow what you've already got. Imagine, you know, we've got literally tens of thousands of businesses in the county of Fresno, for example. If even a small fraction of those businesses added 10 jobs, 50 jobs, 100 jobs, you easily get the same type of job creation value that you would see from some type of a major site expansion. Now, having said all of that, we do aggressively, as the opportunities present themselves, we aggressively pursue them. They typically come through the state and the Economic Development Office out of the governor's office. We learn about them. We work with the Economic Development Corporation, our local industrial real estate community. We aggressively go after those kinds of sort of big fish as they become available. And I think we're actually going to, you know, we're going to land a few. We are becoming more of a location of choice. But frankly, it's because we're doing the difficult work, like changing our land use regulations to make it easy for industrial expansion to happen, making sure we have the water and wastewater infrastructure. In California, that's going to be a huge competitive advantage for the city of Fresno as we move forward. The fact that we can accommodate, especially in the valley, when most cities' water systems are so challenged, we will have the most capacity and will be very successful with business recruitment. In the meantime, making our business climate here really superb for the businesses who are already here, that actually ends up attracting people from the outside anyway. So when we set out, for example, to really stake our claim as the world's leader in fine food and wine resources, we knew it was because that's who we already are, and we did it to expand the companies that are here. But we've started to already see companies, for example, from the LA Basin, who are food-related businesses, want to be here and move their production operations here so they can be a part of this overall ecosystem that really supports the food industry.
I want to turn now to some things related to city finances. Looking back at 2013, one of the defining stories of this year, of course, was Measure G, the residential solid waste outsourcing proposal, which your administration backed as being essential to balancing the city's budget. Of course, in June, voters voted that down. At the heart of that debate, though, was a larger issue of just what is a core city service. Over the past 5 years, there have been major cuts to so many different parts of the city. I'm thinking of areas like parks and community centers. Should people expect a new definition of what is a core city service moving forward, especially as the economy begins to expand? Are we going to see a return to what we had before, do you think? Or are we in a new era where we're going to have nonprofits running our community centers, running our parks, doing those sorts of things that city employees used to do?
I believe that we are in a new normal, and I believe even as the economy comes back, we likely won't return to some of the programs that we were offering when times were aplenty in the early 2000s. I think we learned our lesson. I think, first of all, we're still quite a ways away from truly being financially stable. We're grateful that we're balancing our budget this year and we have enough money coming in to match the expenses going out. And also, we've got money set aside to pay down our debt. But until we pay off those negative fund balances, only then will we begin to build a cash reserve. We were named in, I think it was the Wall Street Journal a few months ago, was one of the most cashless cities in America. And what that means is we just have no cushion. So thankfully, we've been able to reduce our operating expenses. We've really reined in spending so that we can make do with what we've got. But we don't have any money set aside for the emergency. You know, the air conditioner goes out at the police office and, you know, you've got to put that repair bill on your credit card. That's essentially the position we're in as a city. Every day and week and month that goes by that we stay on our current spending plan, we're getting out of that hole. So I'm pretty optimistic that by the end of my time in office, we'll actually have paid off all of those internal debts and be in a position for the first time to have a positive cash reserve. But what we learned from the Great Recession is this: a core service is something that nobody else can do. So when I evaluate the services that we offer at the city of Fresno, no one else can respond to 911 calls in the capacity that we do. No one else is going to respond to structure fire or fire prevention. No one else is going to ensure public space dedicated to parks. Probably folks could help us maintain that a little more efficiently than we might do as a city, but we're the ones who have to ensure that that park space is available. No one else is going to provide water for our residents. Other people can help us provide programming at parks. Other people can help us run community centers. My argument through the Measure G campaign was other people can pick up the trash. In fact, in most of America, private sector businesses do that for us. So let's really focus on what we alone can do so that we're good at that, so that we're financially stable. We can start to rebuild in our areas of core service. Now, of course, I fully accept the voters' direction that they want a municipally provided garbage service. So that's going to be the way of the future. But I will remind people that as they're upset about their water bills going up 30%, if we had been able to privatize the trash service, we could be saving them money and take the edge off of that water rate increase. But that is, I'm not being bitter. I'm just saying that's in large part why I thought it was a good idea. But again, we yield to the process.
Let's turn to public safety. You made national news in mid-November with an op-ed in the New York Times criticizing a Times report about the Bulldog Street Gang's presence in the community. You called the story unfair and inaccurate. Since that piece was published, though, we've seen a rash of gang violence. An off-duty officer was involved in a shooting at a stoplight, another gang-related shooting outside the downtown Fresno ice rink, a drive-by shooting on Olive Avenue just the other day, a shooting in the Fashion Fair Mall parking lot. I could go on and on. To many people, the gang problem is still alive and well. What are you and Chief Dyer doing to reassure residents that it's safe to go to the mall, to go shopping, to be at a stoplight in town, and that they aren't going to be a victim of some random gang violence?
Well, first of all, I will tell you that the chief would let everyone in Fresno know that we are diligent. We are still being extremely diligent. And my response to the New York Times piece was I was trying to point out they're talking like this was, 1999, and it's not. We have reduced the gang population in half or more. That doesn't mean that we can back off. That doesn't mean that, boy, everything's fine and we can just go home and pretend like, there are no continued public safety challenges. So I think Fresnans can rest assured in knowing that we have one of the most creative and effective law enforcement agencies when it comes to dealing with gangs. People come from around the nation to find out what we're doing here because it has worked. I would also remind people that despite the incidents you've mentioned in the last few weeks, overall, our crime statistics are very positive for 2013. We've had about a 26% reduction in homicide, a 14% reduction in rape, 9.5% reduction in robbery, a 4.3% reduction in aggravated assaults. Shootings are down overall 5%. Overall violent crime is down 6.8%. Even on the property crime side, a couple of years ago, we were seeing auto theft rates go back up, even though as they were going back up, they were nowhere near the highest levels in the 90s. But still, they were up, and it was very concerning. But I'm very pleased to report that in the last month, our city hit its all-time low for auto theft rates. So we are making incredible progress, and gosh, I give great credit to the chief and to our officers and to the leadership team at the police department for these kinds of outcomes, despite the fact that we are down a significant number of officers. Now, thankfully, we've been able to begin to hire back, still working within our current budgeted levels. We've hired some officers back, and we're adding back service levels with our new cadet program. We had to let go our non-sworn cadets and community service officers. We just this next month will announce the starting date of 15 of our new cadets. So I think people will see an increase in some of the service levels that they miss from the budget cuts.
Following up on police, for the past few years, the contract with the police officers union has been a major issue come budget negotiations. The union in the past has offered concessions in exchange for an extension of that deal, which your administration rejected. The main part of that contract doesn't expire until 2015, but the no layoffs, no demotions clause actually expires in about 6 months at the end of the fiscal year. What's your strategy moving forward with the FPOA? Are you still hoping to wait and achieve major concessions when that contract comes up in 2015? What's your philosophy there?
Well, we actually look at the police contract like we look at all of our contracts as they come up for negotiation. So we really are focused on those contracts that are open today and reaching agreement with our employees that achieves the budget impact that we need to achieve, but that also is something our employees can agree to. So we've got a couple of major contracts that are open this year. We've got, you know, a few more that open next year. And then when the time comes, we will certainly take up the police contract. And, you know, I think my administration is approaching this in a fair and rational manner. We are being even-handed with all of our employee groups, and that's what we intend to do when the time comes to renegotiate the police contract as well.
One final question before we go. As we enter 2014, by all accounts, the economy is improving. That can only mean good things for the city's general fund. What will your priorities be as we go forward into a new budget year? What are those priorities as we start to see the pendulum swing the other way now and the city of Fresno's financial health improve?
Well, I wish I could say that we've got this great opportunity with next year's budget to establish priorities and new programs. That's not going to be the case. It won't be the case in my time in office when I've got another three budgets to get through. We are rejoicing, frankly, over not having to do more layoffs. We're rejoicing over just being flat or just basically seeing enough revenue come back to the city to make up for the revenue we would have otherwise had through Measure G. So we're grateful that we're at least stable. We want to continue to fund at least our existing operations, see no further reductions in service levels. We will prioritize paying down negative fund balances and establishing a reserve. That's the only way we get truly financially healthy. I think in this next year, though, you'll see us come up with some creative ways to improve landscaping and maintenance of public space over this next year, working with our existing resources. We've got some great staff working on a new approach to using our existing resources more efficiently so we can see fewer weeds and more beautiful public landscaped areas. Obviously, public safety, continued funding at the levels we're at today will be a priority. What we have to do is use our time and energy and persuasion and line up everything we've got to be successful in business expansion, business recruitment, job creation. That is job number one for my office this next year is job creation, starting with the companies who are already here, being more business friendly to support their growth, putting the infrastructure in place to make sure they've got what they need to grow, but then also being very active in recruitment as well. And I think we're going to start to see those efforts pay off. We're already seeing our industrial activity pick up quite a bit, even in the last few months of this calendar year. And I think next year really represents a year of opportunity for our city.
Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen, our guest today on Valley Edition. Mayor Swearingen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Happy holidays to you and your family.
Thank you. Yours as well.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment and learn about how students at Fresno's Sunnyside High School are using meditation to deal with stress, both at home and in the classroom. That's straight ahead on Valley Edition.
The end of the year is almost upon us. It's your last chance to make a donation to Valley Public Radio and receive a tax write-off for 2013. Your gift helps support the programs you enjoy every day, and come next April, it can have benefits as well. Make your tax-deductible donation at kvpr.org.
Gee, ain't it funny?
Thanks, and happy holidays.
Our time slips away.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Let's face it, we're all stressed out, especially at this time of year. But at one local high school, students are learning to deal with that stress through meditation. As FM89's Rebecca Plevin reports, it's part of a larger movement incorporating mindfulness meditation into the classroom.
Just walking into this room with Emily Grant makes you want to slow down and take a deep breath.
Turn and face your palms upward.
The lights are dim, there's soft music playing, and the room smells sweetly of lavender.
Take a few deep breaths in and exhale.
But this isn't a yoga studio. It's a classroom where Grant guides Sunnyside High School's meditation club.
A lot of our students, when they go home, they're not necessarily going home to a safe, relaxing home environment. They may not even be going to a home. So they may not mention it outright, but I know that having a comforting space feels really good to come into.
Grant is the school's health counselor. She and English teacher Everardo Pedraza launched the club last October on Indian freedom fighter Mahatma Gandhi's birthday. Today, the club is helping students find freedom from their stressful lives. Brenda Landeros is a 17-year-old senior.
What made me want to get involved with all the stress I've been having from all these classes. And then, plus my mom has cancer, so yeah, I have to keep the level down.
Meditation might seem like a practice reserved for yoga classes and Zen retreat centers. But more and more, a form of meditation called mindfulness is finding a place in schools.
The condition of the brain and nervous system determine learning. It's that simple.
Chris McKenna is the program director for Mindful Schools, a Bay Area-based group that teaches educators how to use mindfulness in the classroom. He says students across the state are experiencing high levels of stress and trauma, and that affects their ability to learn.
If a kid is stressed out and chronically in some kind of fight, flight, or freeze mode from whatever in his environment, it doesn't matter how many math problems or reading lessons or history lessons you try to pack in the brain. The brain is not in a learning-ready condition.
In mindfulness, students learn to shift their attention from stressful thoughts to more sensory experiences like their breathing or the feeling of their feet on the ground.
You have to give kids a way to shift gears in their brain and nervous system. You have to give them tools that actually allow them to work directly with states of stress. And until you do, you can't really blame them for not paying attention.
He views mindfulness as an invaluable life skill. But the practice has been slower to take hold in Central Valley schools. The Sunnyside Meditation Club is believed to be the only one of its kind between Los Angeles and San Francisco. Lori Granger is a psychotherapist and the director of the Center for Mindfulness in Fresno.
There is a misconception about mindfulness perhaps being a spiritual practice or a religious practice.
She says it's more accurate to think of it as intentional mental health.
How I teach or other people teach mindfulness, in the schools especially, is as a very secular practice, which is one for health and well-being. It does not have to have the spiritual underpinnings from which it came back in, 2,500 years ago.
On a recent Monday, Emily Grant leads a short meditation. About a dozen students sit in a circle and close their eyes.
And as your eyes are closing, I want your shoulders to relax and let them just fall into place. We're going to take a few steps to awaken the energy which each of us has inside of us, but is often dormant.
When the students finish, they look more calm and relaxed. It's a feeling that 16-year-old Alexis Sanchez has come to treasure. She meditates to cope with her heavy load.
My mom and the bills and, like, what my dad, my real dad, actually. But those are the ones that are stressing me out really bad. Yeah, and then, like, my grandma just passed away on Christmas last year, so it's really stressful.
Sometimes she meditates at home and invites her mom or her little sister to join in.
I help my mom pay the bills. I go to work to help her because, like, my older sister, she works, but it's, like, not enough to support us all three girls.
And according to Grant, one of the benefits of meditation is anyone can practice it anytime, anywhere.
And I think what makes meditation special is that it's totally free. You don't need anything but you and your mind and the ability to focus for a period of time.
It's a skill that Grant and others hope students will be able to draw on for the rest of their lives. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
You're listening to Valley Edition. California is a place where medical device makers can thrive. The industry says employment in the sector is growing, and companies here benefit from almost half the biomedical venture capital dollars nationwide. This year, some medical device businesses have faced a new tax under the Affordable Care Act. Healthcare reporter Pauline Bartolone in Sacramento says the industry has a mixed reaction.
No one likes to be taxed. And for small businesses, the added costs can be especially unwelcome.
We just write checks out for the tax, and we haven't really seen any of the benefits.
Jim Thompson is the financial officer for Gold Standard Diagnostics in Davis. The 40-employee company makes kits that medical laboratory workers use to run tests. It also sells a machine that runs those diagnostics so people don't have to. Since the beginning of this year, Gold Standard has paid a 2.3% tax on most of its sales.
What is difficult for small businesses is that there are no exemptions or there are no levels or limits. It's straight off of revenue, regardless of the size of the company you are, and regardless of whether you're a profitable company or not a profitable company.
Thompson says Gold Standard has paid tens of thousands of dollars in federal taxes under the Affordable Care Act. It has chosen, for now, not to pass the new cost onto consumers.
So the direct impact for us is to hire less people, you know, be able to fund less projects, do things that we would like to do that are more innovative.
But Thompson says Gold Standard is still planning for growth next year. The federal health law promises millions more insured people. But Thompson says it's not clear how that will improve his bottom line.
What you're seeing right now is just a lot of uncertainty.
The tax Gold Standard Diagnostics pays helps finance healthcare under the new law. But Dylan Roby with the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research says the medical device industry is not the only one helping to pay for the law.
There's a 10% tanning bed tax. There's a tax on individuals earning over $200,000 a year to help make Medicare solvent.
There's also a sales tax on health insurance policies. Roby says the general idea is that industries that benefit from the new insured population will give something back.
All of these groups, hospitals, device manufacturers, big pharma, they're all going to incur new revenue and new customers because of the fact that 30 million people are going to get insurance who didn't have insurance before. And so any losses that they'll feel by paying fees or paying taxes into the system will be offset by the fact that they're going to have new paying customers.
The device tax has repeatedly been a target for repeal in Congress. Some say it stifles innovation. Roby doesn't believe it.
It shouldn't have any impact on innovation because where we're sensitive to price, it tends to be in things that aren't necessarily innovative where there's lots of competition. But when a new innovative product comes to market, it should be just as easy for the device manufacturer to retain the price they want to charge.
Not all Sacramento area medical device companies agree the tax is a problem. Vikram Janarthan is CEO of Ancira Therapeutics. He's developing a mechanism to help stroke patients.
We've got a miniaturized device the size of four strands of human hair that goes in through the groin and grabs a clot and pulls it out safely so the patient can walk out through the front door of the hospital.
Janarthan's company doesn't pay any tax because its product is still in development. He says device makers like him could work for 7 to 12 years before their products get to market and be subject to the tax. Janarthan says he hopes device makers look at the big picture.
If there are new consumers coming on board, the opportunity to sell your innovative technology for a bigger player that is committed to the space and is thirsty for new innovative ideas, that hasn't gone away. Yes, there are a lot of hurdles, but making a life-saving device takes some intestinal fortitude.
He says that fortitude means a 2.3% tax won't scare him away. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
You're listening to Valley Edition. The San Joaquin Valley is a huge place, but sometimes, and with some stories, it's actually a very small place. And what happens in one part of the valley has a direct connection to what happens 150 miles away. That's the case with our next story, how water from farmers in Kern County could soon fuel the next wave of Fresno's northward expansion across the San Joaquin River. Back in the 1990s, when the University of California was planning on building a new campus in the San Joaquin Valley, the Regents looked at a number of locations before finally settling on Merced. It was a fierce competition, with Fresno County and Madera County each fielding their own pitches. Madera's plan called for the new university to be built right on the bluffs of the San Joaquin River, overlooking Fresno. But while the campus went elsewhere, plans for massive new development in the area continued. In about 50 years, Highway 41 around Children's Hospital will be flanked by two new developments that together will comprise a city the size of Modesto, population 200,000. They're known as Rio Mesa and Gateway Village. Smart growth advocates have called these plans typical suburban sprawl, but others say they're just the next step in the region's growth and essential to Madera County's future. One problem, of course, has been water. And that's where our next guest comes in, Lois Henry of the Bakersfield Californian, who in a column earlier this month titled How Water from Kern Grows Sprawl in Madera reported on the murky shuffling of Kern County ag water to help build Gateway Village. Lois Henry joins us now. Lois, welcome.
Hi, Joe.
Now, these water exchanges happen all the time. They themselves aren't anything new. They aren't illegal. But as I understand it, there are some laws in place to restrict ag water being used for development. And this latest plan that you've uncovered kind of skirts around them a little bit, at least the intent of the laws. Tell us about the specifics here with Gateway Village and where this water is coming from.
Right. This one, and I don't know if I would go so far as to say they skirt the laws as much as they use the laws very, very finely. I don't know how to put that. Okay, so you've got Gateway Village, which was proposed by Castle & Cook, which, you know, is another major Bakersfield company. So we have these ties back and forth, which are kind of interesting. So Castle & Cook proposed Gateway Village way back into the, like, early 90s. And it's always been essentially the same. It's 2,000 acres just north of Children's Hospital, 6,500 homes. And it would use 6,300 acre feet a year of water. That's a lot of water for any readers or, I'm sorry, listeners who don't know. An acre foot is essentially, imagine a football field covered in a foot of water. That's an acre foot. So it's a lot of water. So they proposed Gateway Village, and then at some point, I think in 1998, Root Creek Water District was formed, and its boundaries overlap Gateway Village. And the developers decided that they would go through Root Creek, and Root Creek would buy water from Madera Irrigation District when, and I'm using air quotes with my fingers here, when available. They would buy the excess water from Madera Irrigation District, which is right next door, when available. So the Madera Board of Supervisors said, no, we're not comfortable with that when available deal. We want you to go out and find a backup source of water. So those developers then went back to the drawing board and they looked for backup water, which they found here in Kern County.
So let me jump in here. The developers in Madera are saying, okay, you want more water? We'll find more water. Let's make a deal with some folks down in Kern County. Where did they go and how did that come about?
This is how it works. Paramount Farms, which is owned by Linda and Stuart Resnick, billionaires in Los Angeles, they own a ranch in Tulare County where they grow citrus. And that ranch has rights to the Cahuilla River, about 9,200 acre feet a year. They don't use all that water there on their ranch, and so they ship that water through the Fryant-Kern Canal to be banked in the North Kern Water Storage District here in Kern County, where they also are a major landowner. And so Gateway went through Paramount and said, you know, we want to get some of that water. And Paramount said, yeah, okay, we'll go ahead and do that. And how they do it is they give it over to Shafter Wasco Irrigation District, which is a CVP contractor. And then Shafter Wasco Irrigation District calls up the Bureau of Reclamation, and the Bureau releases a like amount of water from Millerton Lake directly to Madera Irrigation District, which then delivers it to Gateway / Root Creek. So it's not, you're not actually moving, you know, volumes of water up the valley. It's an exchange. It's, you know, we're going to move this here, and in exchange, you'll move that there. So that's how the deal was worked. And Madera Board of Supervisors said, great, we love this very firm amount of water. If you ever need it, you know, you can call on it you can purchase it through Paramount.
And this is where there's a catch, right?
Here's the deal. Paramount is not a CVP contractor. They had to go through the Bureau of Reclamation and ask to please allow us to move our water through your system and get it down to North Kern. You know, and they'd been doing that for many years prior to the Gateway thing. And the Bureau of Reclamation said, yeah, okay, great. We're going to do an environmental assessment. And they did some other documentation in previous years. In that environmental assessment, it says very clearly, this water shall only be used for agriculture or groundwater recharge, and it shall not be used in such a manner as to trigger any land use changes. Okay, so that's the water, the Paramount water, that's being banked here in North Kern. Similarly, when Root Creek said, hey, Bureau of Reclamation, we've got this deal where we kind of want to buy this when available water from Madera Irrigation District, the Bureau of Reclamation said, okay, well, we're going to need to do an environmental assessment on that as well. And so they did, and in that environmental assessment, they said the same thing. This water shall be used for agriculture and groundwater recharge only and shall not be used in a manner that it would trigger a land use change, meaning ag to urban. But when you look at what they went out and did and why they were doing it, and they went to the Board of Supervisors and they basically said, this is the water we're buying in order to support this urbanization. So I asked the Bureau, well, wait a minute, you're putting these limitations on this water, and it's clearly not going to be used for that. I mean, I guess technically speaking, what they're going to do is they're going to take delivery of that water, and they're going to take it at S&J Farms up in Madera, which, by the way, is owned by Paramount. Interesting little tie-in. And they're going to run it on the crops at that Paramount farm. It's going to go into the groundwater, and at that point, I guess, their contention is they have complied with the limitations of the Bureau of Reclamation. However, my contention is the whole point of this was you were going to get that water up there so that you could get it into the ground so that you could pump it back out and use it for Gateway Village. That's the whole point of it. If you happen to water a few trees on the way, okay, I guess, so much the better. So to me, you know, the whole thing is a little bit disingenuous. This is all being done through a taxpayer-funded and owned and maintained system. So anyway, that's my contention, is just it seems like these limitations that the feds put on this water are being adhered to in a sort of with a wink and a nod that this is really going to urbanization. And then, you know, like I said, you know, enriching two private companies using taxpayer-supported means. Is that something we're all okay with? If we are, okay, great. But I just sort of threw it out there.
It's a very, very interesting story indeed, and I'm sure we'll continue to follow it again. If you just joined us today, our guest is Lois Henry from the Bakersfield Californian. Her column titled How Water from Kern Grows Sprawl in Madera is available online at bakersfield.com. Lois Henry, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
Well, that's all for this Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition's reporter Rebecca Plevin, and producer Ezra David Romero, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Happy holidays, everyone.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.